You're now recording. Thank you for the reminder. And hey, all that stuff on vitamin C didn't get recorded, but maybe that's just as well. And now let me...
I have a question.
Okay, quick question.
Yes, if you're not taking the vitamin C, but you're eating a lot of oranges and tangerines, and they say like even 5 oranges equal to 1 lemon of vitamin C. If you have oranges and lemons, isn't that better than vitamin C?
Well, it is in the sense that you're getting other nutrients along with the vitamin C that actually complement the effectiveness of the vitamin C. And yeah, with this run now on vitamin C tablets, I think that's what people are going to have to do. And you can get over 200 milligrams into your body per day just by eating 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. It doesn't have to be oranges. I mean, things like broccoli have vitamin C in it. Leafy vegetables do. Cabbage does. So, but yeah, oranges are kind of at the top of the list. I've heard mandarin oranges are actually even better, but tomatoes are very high in vitamin C. But yeah, if you just eat your fruits and vegetables, you're practically guaranteed to get 200 milligrams. And all the scientific evidence tells us that in terms of trying to help you recover from the cold and the flu, 200 milligrams does just as well as 1 gram a day. So that should do it. Okay, let me get back to the... Okay, here we go. And this is a couple of books I wanted to recommend. Anybody who wants to dig into this in more detail, Who is Adam? The book written by Fuzz Rana myself. And you get a free chapter at reasons.org/Rana. And then you can get a free chapter of Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, where I got several chapters on the exceptionalism of the soulish animals and the exceptionalism of us human beings relative to those animals. Again, a free chapter at reasons.org/Ross. And just a quick review, those of you who want to dig into really scientific depth onto human origins, Reasons to Believe sponsored a workshop in our headquarters several weeks ago. It was an all-day workshop where we invited scientists who are experts on human origins, including atheist scientists, theistic evolutionary scientists. And they were basically there to engage us and critique our model. I think it's really interesting, the critique that they offered and the engagement we had with them. That all got recorded, and you can watch all those at reasons.org/human origins workshop 2020. And this is just a little joke that I created. Feel free to put whatever sports figure you want over there in the extreme left. And last week, we went into these different evidences for human exceptionalism. Namely that we have a symbolic expression, the capacity to invent and manipulate symbols. Capable of explosive technological advance, manufacture and wear clothes, and be able to invent and use complex language. Again, this is all recorded and posted at reasons.org, or primarily paradoxes.org. Go to paradoxes.org and you'll see a link where you can download the recording from last week, where we went into all these different evidences for human exceptionalism. Able to form complex social structures, invent and use complex trading, and engage in mathematics, literature, and theology. And just give me a time to catch up here because a lot of what you see is blocked on my screen, which is why I run this with 2 computers. My second computer actually shows everything, but I need to get caught up here. Yeah, ability to engage in mathematics, literature, philosophy, and theology. And an ability to tame, domesticate, and train the nephesh animals, the soulish animals, the animals that God endowed with soulish characteristics so that they can serve and please us human beings, form relationships with the human beings, and God designed them in such a way that they're actually capable of doing altruistic acts for their humans that they're emotionally bonded to. Again, this is all covered in the recording from last week. So let me pick up on the new material that we've not yet covered, and that's looking at the case we have for the exceptional morphology of human beings. Basically looking at the physical features of the human body that make the point that we indeed are exceptional compared to all other life. And the first point I'd like to talk about is the fact that we of all creatures have an unusual shape of our skull. You'll notice that the head of a human being, you basically see a lot of room in the skull for the front part of the skull, and is designed to be able to accommodate a very large parietal lobe. And it's that parietal lobe in the front of your skull that enables you to do mathematics and philosophy, to be able to invent things. That's where our symbolic capability resides, is in that lobe. And we are unique amongst all the bipedal primates, both past and present, in that we got the appropriate skull structure and shape to be able to accommodate a large parietal lobe. Now, we do see that there is a parietal lobe in the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, possibly Homo erectus, but it's radically smaller compared to what we see with human beings. And people have made the point that the Neanderthal brain was the same size as a human brain. That is true, but the parietal lobe in the human brain is much bigger, far bigger than it is in the Neanderthal brain. And incidentally, we have a greater ratio of brain mass to body mass than is the case for Neanderthal. And in terms of what you can do with your brain, that's what really counts, is this encephalization quotient, the percentage of your body mass that's devoted to the brain. And we are way above that of all the other bipedal primates that have preceded us. The second thing that sets us apart is our hand dexterity. We're able to do things with our hands that no other primate is capable of doing. I mean, for example, you cannot put a chimpanzee in front of a piano and have him play a Liszt concerto. It's just not capable of doing that. Or, I mean, you can put, again, a chimpanzee or an ape in front of a typewriter. They can make the typewriter do things, but they're not going to be able to do 100 words per minute, where they're able to actually pick up the symbols or the keys that they want on the keyboard. It's because we humans have this amazing hand dexterity that we're able to play musical instruments at a very rapid, complex nature, and all of us now can sit in front of computers. And I think what's really interesting, we had this from the beginning, and it's only recently that we've been able to fully exploit the hand dexterity that we were granted with. I'm basically making the point that it's not something you can simply attribute to naturalistic evolution, that it was survival of the fittest. You don't need the dexterity of being able to play Liszt, for example, on the piano, if your livelihood is based on being able to effectively kill a bison or an antelope. It's a different kind of dexterity to throw a spear or to use a bow and arrow than it is to be able to play a piano or to be able to write at 100 words per minute on a computer. This is unique to human beings. We got the skeletal and muscular structure, the nerve support to give us this amazing hand dexterity. And it's like God created us human beings knowing what we would need at the beginning of our existence, tens of thousands of years ago, and what we would need in the 21st century to be able to function. So literally for thousands of years, we had this amazing hand dexterity that's really only being fully exploited at this time. And I think what's especially interesting is that we have a hand dexterity that actually enables us to be able to sit and stay in front of a piano and play that piano for hours per day. In other words, the dexterity is able to be sustained for a long period of time. And likewise, you're like me, you're sitting in front of a computer screen typing, you know, literally hours per day. And we're capable of doing that. And then the other thing that makes us unique is the long infant to adolescent development time. for all you men out there, it took you 25 years to develop from the time that you were born to when you were able to be fully functional as an adult. Your lung and brains basically come in at the end. Women develop a little faster. They're fully developed by the time they're 24 years, but no non-human animal comes close to this long development time. About the best you see is about 8 years outside of human beings. And this also means that parents have to be prepared to devote a significant support. In other words, it's going to take 20 years before the children that you gave birth to are going to be able to fully function as an adult. And nowadays, when you have to have a graduate degree to be able to fully function in society, you're basically having to care and provide for your children until they're 25, 30 years of age. And so it's like we human beings are able to do what we do because of this long development time. It explains, for example, why we have such an amazingly functional brain. I mean, when you're born, your brain is only a third the size that it is when you're an adult. And so we have the growth of the brain taking place over this long period of time. And as it goes over that long period of time, there's actually features of the brain that come into effect. We all joke about how teenagers are not really ready to socially function during their teenage years. It's because that part of the brain is still developing. So literally takes time, literally 24, 25 years before we reach that. This is unique to human beings. And then we have a very high metabolic rate. We have a fairly fast heart rate. We're able to do things. And what's amazing about human beings is they have a physical body that's capable of a high energy output for sustained periods of time. I mean, I don't know how many of you ever run a marathon, but this is something that's unique to human beings, is that we're able to sustain a high metabolic rate literally for hours on end. I mean, if you look at the other predators on the planet, I mean, a good example is a cheetah. A cheetah can run about 2.5 times faster than a human being, but only for a short period of time. After a couple of minutes, the cheetah gets heat exhausted and has to stop, whereas we human beings can continue. And it's because of our capacity to sustain a long or a high metabolic rate for a long period of time that the early humans were able to outcompete the other predators on the planet. In the sense that, we couldn't run as fast as the other predators, but we could do sustained running for a long period of time. And in early humanity, that's how they were able to be successful in their hunting. They would hunt in groups, but they would basically run down their prey that could run twice as fast as they could. They would just keep their prey running until the prey metabolic rate caught up with it. They got exhausted and had to stop, and the humans would come in for the kill. And also this was, well, let me go on. We have a long lifespan. I mean, when you look at the other primates, they can live 20, 30, 40 years. We can live 80, 90, 100 years. And during that long lifespan, we can sustain our high metabolic rate. What you notice with a lot of other mammals on planet Earth is that when they get old, their metabolic rate drops. Whereas what we see with human beings, you've got humans in their 70s, and yes, their metabolic rate is not as great as it was when they were in their 20s, but they're still able to perform at a very high level. And so, for example, there are people who run marathons or people who run sprints in their 70s and 80s, and they can maintain a fairly decent time. So it's a joke at our office that every year we do this 5-kilometer run. And even though I'm the oldest one in the run, because I've been keeping myself in shape, I always finish first amongst our group. Not first in the whole group, of course, but just amongst our staff. And of course, I use that as a way to try to motivate them to get into shape. You know, why are you letting somebody? But this is something that's unique to human beings. Our capacity to sustain a high metabolic rate hour after hour, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, and decade after decade. And when you compare human beings to all their life forms, we have, compared to all their mammals on planet Earth, and this would be true of the birds as well, during our lifespan, we experience about 4 times as many heartbeats as any other life. This is the amazing thing about the human body, is that if you look at longevity in terms of how many heartbeats you experience over your lifespan, we're literally a factor of 4 against our best competition in the animal world. And so we have a long lifespan, but we're able to do things. I mean, turtles, for example, can outlive us. Some turtle species can, but they're not doing much in their life, whereas we can sustain high productivity literally for many decades. High encephalization quotient. This is a technical term that refers to the percentage of your body mass that your brain takes. And for humans, it's about 3%, assuming you've got a slim body build. It's about 3%. And compared to all other species of primates, again, past and living, our encephalization quotient is at the top. In fact, it's almost the highest amongst all animals on the face of the earth. I think we're beat out by a couple of bird species. Hummingbirds, for example, have a slightly higher encephalization quotient than we human beings. That's because birds, for example, have they got a similar brain structure to we human beings. No big parietal lobe, of course, but they have their brain structured in such a way that they can pack in a lot more neurons per cubic centimeter, and explains why birds, for example, do show such high intellectual capability, especially crows and ravens. And the thing about birds you need to realize is they got hollow bones. And so encephalization is talking about the weight of the brain compared to the weight of the rest of the body. But if you actually take into account that birds are designed to have very light body mass because they have to be able to fly with the hollow bones, and the internal structure is also much lighter, be taken into account, we actually are at the top in terms of encephalization quotient. And then we have a very high leg to height ratio. Again, if you look at the other primates, both past and present, their arms are quite long compared to the legs, not true of human beings, which explains why we're able to use our legs with such efficient mobility, and have the arms of sufficiently short size. That again, it's part of the explanation for why we have high hand dexterity. But this is unique to human beings. This actually plays a role in us being able to cool our bodies. Again, to go back to that point about how early humans were able to out-hunt lions and tigers and cheetahs by hunting for long periods of time, because we could sustain a metabolism for a long period of time, but also took advantage of the fact that we are morphologically designed to keep our bodies cool. And so early humans would hunt during the hottest part of the day, while all the other predators were taking a nap under the shade of a tree, being so hot that they just couldn't do anything except to take a nap. Whereas humans were able to, because of their unique morphology, be able to hunt even during the hottest part of the day. Or today, we can work during the hottest part of the day because of our unique capacity to cool. And one of those features is the fact that we have a very high leg to height ratio that actually plays a significant role in us being able to shed a lot of our internal body heat and keep our bodies cool. And we have a slender skeletal frame. Now, Neanderthals probably have a morphology that's most similar to us amongst all the apes, past and present. But if you look at their skeletal frame, it's kind of barrel-shaped, whereas humans have a very slim, slender skeletal frame, and it's all designed to keep us cool. Neanderthals had short legs and short arms. We have long legs and arms slightly longer than they did, but it's our slim skeletal frame that enables us to keep our bodies cool to a degree that's not possible with the other primates that share the planet with us. And We also have very little body hair. They refer to humans as the naked ape. We don't have our bodies covered with thick fur, which is what you see with the gorillas and the chimpanzees, the orangutans. And we see evidence for this in Neanderthals as well. We are virtually naked, very little fur or hair in our bodies. And that plays a huge role in us being able to keep our bodies cool during a time of heat. And we also have an efficient body cooling system. We're able to perspire like no other animal. The only animal that comes close to matching our perspiration system is the horse. And that's one reason why humans and horses bonded so well, is that horses were able to perspire like human beings. And so they were able to keep going in the heat of the day. And also they could wear clothes. We could put clothes on the horses and keep them warm when it got cold. And this is what's so special about human beings, is that we have this amazing morphology in every way possible that enables us to stay cool when it is hot. And because we have this huge parietal lobe, our creator knew it would be no problem for us to quickly develop clothing technology. And it's with clothing technology that we're able to keep our bodies warm when it got cold. But because of our morphology, we were able to stay very cool. Very little body hair, tall, slender build. And we have this amazing perspiration system and long leg to height ratio. All these are factors that keep us cool. In fact, some studies in the scientific literature have said, now that we have widespread air conditioning in our cars, our homes, our places of work, our transportation system, that this is actually one reason why we're seeing the development of an obesity problem in the human species. We no longer have to deal with the heat that forces us to keep our bodies slender. We have this air conditioning that we've been able to develop, and that explains why we're seeing the human population no longer as slender as they were generations ago. But we were designed with the body morphology to keep ourselves cool. I see that my time is up. I'm gonna stop. Where I'm gonna go next week, just to give you a little bit of a heads up, where I'm gonna go next week, we're gonna look at the unique genes that we humans have. I'm gonna spend some time on this. That's because this has been the area of greatest pushback from non-theistic anthropologists, making the claim that our genes are just like the genes of other apes on the planet, both past and present. There's really nothing unique, but actually there are significant features of our genome and our genes, the way our genes operate, that sets us apart from all the life on planet Earth. We'll get into that next week. So with that, I'm going to exit and get us back. Okay, we should all be back now. And so I'll take questions on any topic that you care to raise. And you can write in the chat feature, but you're also, all you need to do is unmute your microphone to ask a question. I will hear you. And if you're waiting, you can go to the chat box and actually put your hand up. Yeah, but if I see a hand there, I know to go to you next. And I can't promise to read everything in the chat column, but I'll do my best. But what's most convenient for me, if you just unmute your microphone, and when you do that, everybody's going to be able to hear you. So I'm going to okay, all of you should be able to unmute your microphone now. Okay, I'm going to ask all of you, please mute your microphone.
I was so upset.
You got a lot of background noise here. You all need to mute your microphone. You take questions one at a time. The mute button is to the lower left. Go to the lower left. You'll see a little microphone there. And all you need to do is go over it and it'll mute it. And when you want to ask a question, then you just unmute it.
How's the question?
Okay, who's first? Go for it.
Laundry detergent will kill it.
I can't quite hear you.
Water is effective for all
wash your hands frequently for 5 to 10 minutes, but a lot can happen during that time. You can rub your eyes, pick your nose unwittingly, and so on.
Okay, I need all of you to mute your microphone. We're getting quite a bit of background noise.
Salt in warm water.
Again, if you're on a phone, there's a mute feature on the phone. And if you're on a computer or other kind of device, it's at the lower left. I'm hearing somebody's recording. So yeah, please let's, thank you. That works. Okay, who wants to be first on the questions?
Don't listen, do they?
Mm-hmm. Can I go?
There he is again.
I'll get Sharon.
Okay, Doug, go for it.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I was talking to some atheists today, and you know, they're just talking about how God would allow all this to happen, particularly little children. There was a child that died today. That was this is the first one that I've heard of that was under 1 year old. And so, you know, they're questioning God's integrity. So maybe you could comment on, you know, why God allows that to happen. I have my own ideas, but I'd like to hear yours.
Okay, about 2 months ago, I answered that question, and that did get recorded. So if you go to paradoxes.org, you can actually watch the class that we had on the benefits of viruses, why a good God would create viruses. And tomorrow at reasons.org, I got a blog coming out that also addresses that question. Why would a good God create viruses? Where I make the point.
I'm sorry. My question wasn't about viruses, though. My question was, like, why do innocent people suffer? I guess it's more of a general question about suffering. I know it's a big, long discussion, but maybe you could.
I'll get to that, Doug. I'm okay. Just saying that this article that comes out tomorrow will talk about the benefits that we accrue from viruses. We humans literally wouldn't be on planet Earth without viruses. They play very crucial roles. But I'm also in that blog coming out tomorrow and in the recording that's already up there looking at why we get bad viruses like this COVID-19. And if you look at the viral attacks that have done the most damage in the 20th century, things like SARS-1, you know, MERS, HIV. These viruses all came about as a result of we human beings disobeying the commands that God gave us in the Old Testament and how we're to manage our health and how we're to manage the health of the animals that we domesticate. I think what's pretty interesting, these pandemics that we can document over the past 100 years, every one of them has arisen as a result of animal to human transmission, where a relatively benign virus became a deadly virus, basically thanks to human neglect and human abuse. And my whole point is, God created this wonderful world for us to enjoy. He created it with bacteria, with viruses. He created it so that we would maximally benefit. And, you know, there are trade-offs when God's got multiple purposes. I mean, that's one thing I put in my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. About 20 different purposes that we can see for God making the universe the way he did. But when you got all these different purposes, it's like the things we do for an automobile. There are trade-offs. You cannot buy an automobile that has maximum gas efficiency and maximum road performance. Road performance means you're going to burn up a lot of gasoline. So you do a trade-off. We say, here's a vehicle that's got decent gas mileage, but also really good road performance. And you see the same thing in our universe. And so if you want a universe where sin and evil can be efficiently eradicated, it means you need a universe with thermodynamics, with gravity, and with electromagnetism. And when you got those laws of physics, you're going to require things like viruses and bacteria in order to make the existence of human beings possible and human civilization possible. However, it's like what we did with mosquitoes. Mosquitoes at one time were limited to just 10% of the continental land masses where very few humans lived. But thanks to human abuse, they now occupy more than 99% of the continental land masses. Likewise, viruses never intended to be a problem have been made deadly because of human abuse. I'm thinking that one of the great benefits that come up again, please mute your microphone if you're not speaking. I think one of the benefits we're going to accrue from this COVID-19 crisis, maybe we'll see to these wet markets where you got these
intelligent people cities, here.
These huge cities where you got literally tens of thousands of animals, live animals on sale in very crowded cages where they can't move, where the animals are highly stressed, packed very tightly together, and in contact with millions of human beings that likewise are packed together. Whenever you pack birds or mammals in a very tightly dense situation where they can't move, you're gonna stress them. And when you put them in the contact with millions of people, likewise are packed close together and in stressful situations, that's a perfect environment for encouraging the mutation of viruses. And that explains how we got HIV, SARS-1, now the SARS-2, and some of the deadly flus that took place earlier in the 20th century. And again, if you want to dig deeper into this, I'd recommend the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. Okay, I got a hand up from Karina. You want to go for it? Just unmute.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. Well, I don't know if it's a question or just a comment, but once I heard that one of the exceptional characteristics of human beings is our capacity to handle fire, and that's the way we get to be this modern civilization species. So I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Yes, good question, Karina. There is evidence that chimpanzees and Neanderthals took advantage of fire, but no evidence that they ever controlled fire. For example, field studies show that when there's a wildfire, chimpanzees will throw nuts into the fire, then move away from the fire, knowing that the fire is going to soften those nuts. So when the fire is over, they go back and they're able to break open those nuts and eat the meat that's inside. And there's some evidence that Neanderthals likewise were using fire opportunistically, but they never had control of it. Because of human dexterity, we're able to actually start fires from scratch. So, you see the whole idea of rubbing two sticks together to make a sufficient friction that you can get kindling to spark and ignite. That takes significant hand dexterity to pull that off. And that's something we don't see in any other non-human animal, the ability to take, you know, sticks, for example, and use them in such a way to actually start a fire or to have the dexterity to use a flint stone to spark and to get some kindling going. Or just the whole idea that we have a large enough parietal lobe that we know, for example, where to get kindling material. Just to tell a quick story, I was raised in coastal British Columbia, but I remember one time where my father took me and my two sisters out to the beach in pouring rain and said, okay, now we're gonna start a fire and we're not gonna use matches. And he said, Dad, everything is soaking wet out here. Are you kidding? And he said, look at all the driftwood out there. In the middle of that driftwood is heartwood. It's soft and it's dry and it's very easy to get a fire going. And so we would collect that. And he said, no, before you collect it, we need to build a lean-to. We build a lean-to in order to protect the material from the heart of that driftwood from getting wet from the rain. So he built a lean-to to be able to actually protect the heartwood and the kindling. And he showed us how to actually, it took a shoelace off of our shoe. We built a little bow and arrow and actually used a piece of wood and got it moving really fast. It's much easier than trying to rub two sticks together. But notice, it takes a large parietal lobe to realize I need to make a complex tool. Basically using a piece of wood and some sinew to make a bow, then to wrap it around a piece of wood so that I can move it back and forth and make that piece of wood spin very rapidly, much more rapidly than I can do by rubbing two sticks together. And so we were able to start a fire in pouring rain without matches. But that's unique to human beings, the capacity to do that. And there are articles in the scientific literature claiming that Neanderthals had control of fire, where they think they've got a hearth, but those papers are disputed. And I looked at those papers, and no way did this little slab of wood show any evidence that it was actually a constructed hearth and a fireplace that was used by Neanderthals. Basically wishful thinking. The best we can say about the Neanderthals, they were like the chimpanzees. They were able to opportunistically take advantage of wildfires, but no evidence, at least no undisputed evidence, that they had any capacity to control fire, to start a fire and to be able to control it for their use and their benefit. But you're making a good point, Karina. It's our ability to control fire that meant with our slender bodies that are very poorly adapted for cold, that we could keep our bodies warm enough under cold conditions. It's not just our clothing, it's our ability to create heat from controlling fire that enable us to be very effective. In fact, there's research papers showing that humans were able to quickly displace the Neanderthals in conditions where it was 15 degrees Fahrenheit colder than the coldest temperature Neanderthals were able to function in. So even though our bodies were very poorly designed for cold, much more poorly designed than the Neanderthal bodies were, we were able to survive in a much colder climate zone than they were because we developed clothing technology and because we could control fire, and we see no evidence that that was the case for Neanderthals. Okay, who's next?
Hi.
Okay, I see two hands up. Rosa, why don't you go for it?
Thanks. I just want to say hello from British Columbia. I'm in Vancouver.
Oh, that's my hometown.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Hugh. My question is, how do I or the layperson differentiate between an article that's peer-reviewed versus not?
See you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Good question. I mean, this is a big problem with the internet these days. You see all these very scientifically sounding articles that are published making these claims, and a lot of news stories. And I say, yeah, read those stories. But for example, if there's a news story about a scientific claim that's up on the web, I always look at that story to see if they give me a link to the peer-reviewed paper. If there's no link there, and they don't cite a paper, or at least give me a way I can find the paper, then I basically don't trust what they're saying. The more credible news stories will always give you the link. That's something I make a point of doing on my Twitter page, for example. I use my Twitter page to alert you to all the new scientific discoveries that are relevant to Christian faith. But notice, I always give you a link to the peer-reviewed paper. And what you notice in the peer-reviewed scientific and medical literature, the abstracts are free to the public. Yes, they often charge for you to read the paper, but you can always get the abstract free. And here's another tip. If the paper has been published in a peer-reviewed journal, you can always get the preprint. And the preprint won't be exactly like the journal article, but it'll be close enough. And those preprints are free in their entirety. So you can actually read the entire paper in its preprint form just by going to a site called arxiv.org that lists all the preprints of medical and the scientific research papers. But again, I wouldn't trust the preprint unless you know that it got at least accepted, if not published, in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. And they say, how do you know whether or not the journal is peer-reviewed? Well, for example, if it's published by an organization that is taking articles from way outside its organization, I mean, for example, I made a comment about this one organization that's publishing all these papers in vitamin C. I think it's Ortho something. And the problem was they do have a scientific journal, but it's an internal journal. Basically, they're not accepting articles from outside their organization. And, they're simply internally publishing it. By the way, Christians do the same thing. The Discovery Institute, for example, has their own journal. And so it's not recognized as a peer-reviewed journal because it's just a place where their people can publish stuff without the external scientific peer review report. And the best way is to actually go to the opening pages of the journal, and those again are available free to the public. It'll explain to you their whole peer review process. And also, if you look at the paper, it'll actually show you when the paper was submitted, when it was peer reviewed, when it went back, and when it was corrected. So if you see all that in there, and if you notice that the reviewers are anonymous. So for example, when I submitted a research paper to the Astrophysical Journal, that journal did not reveal to me who was reviewing my article. And by the way, they always ask for at least some revisions to your article. And so you also see a date for the revision. So those are some tips on how to determine what you can trust and what you can't trust. And incidentally, even if the paper got published in the peer-reviewed literature, it's always good to look at other papers published on the same topic. PubMed and NASA maintains websites. PubMed maintains a website where they archive all the research papers published in the life sciences. NASA, and it's actually through adsww.harvard.edu. It's maintained by NASA, but they maintain an archive of all the physical science research papers. And all you need to do is pick a couple of words that kind of give you the topic, put it in there, and it'll pop up all the research papers that have been published as far back as you want. That will allow you to see whether the paper you're reading has been disputed by other research scientists. So I just say, if you want to be careful, actually do a fairly exhaustive search of the scientific literature on the topic. That'll give you an idea of the consensus of the scientific community on that particular topic. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I'm having to tell people all the time on social media what they can trust and what they can't trust. It's probably a little longer answer than you wanted, but hey, I want to take advantage of that thing. Okay, I see a couple more hands up. Matt Dieter, you want to go for it?
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate your ministry, Ross. I posted on the chat. I don't know if anybody can see that. But right. I was wondering what your thoughts are on Genesis 9:2. I try to argue this with young earth creationists using Job 39 and the ethology of the horse as a way to show God's plan for death prior to the fall. And why would he create the ethology of the horse from the beginning to be built for war and not afraid of battle and that kind of a thing? But what they counter with is Genesis 9:2, in that God could potentially have created a different ethology in animals after he's already rested from creation. So I was just wondering if you've come across that or what your thoughts would be on that.
Yeah, I have. And I address that question in my book, A Matter of Days. Basically making the point, this is good with any young earth comment, look at the larger biblical context. Don't look just at Genesis 9:2, look at all the verses before and afterwards. And what you see in those early verses of Genesis 9 is God's basically saying to Noah and his family, before you were on a vegetarian diet, now I'm giving you permission to eat meat. And young earth creationists interpret this as the first time that carnivorous activity came upon the face of the earth, although some will say carnivorous activity existed after Adam sinned. They'll put it on Adam's sin. And what's going on here in Genesis 9, God is basically saying, based on Genesis 6, I'm shortening your lifespan. Your lifespan is now going to be so short that it's not going to be a problem for you to eat meat. So go ahead and eat meat. Whereas if you got people with a potential to live 900 years, It's important that they not be consuming meat, because meat concentrates heavy metals in your body at a rate of about 1,000 times more than if you're consuming just vegetation. But since our maximum lifespan is 120 years, no problem with supplementing your diet with meat. That's the context of what we see in Genesis chapter 9. But also what you see in Genesis 9 too is God is saying, I'm going to put the fear of man upon those creatures that you're going to be eating. And basically making the point, look, if I didn't put this, God designed birds and mammals with a desire to come to humans and to relate to humans and serve and please them. And this is going to be a problem if humans are hunting them for food. I mean, they're going to be drawn towards us, and we have the temptation of literally wiping them out. This is what happened to the passenger pigeon. Passenger pigeons really like human beings, and they wanted to be with us to such a high degree that when hunters were shooting them out of the trees at rates of thousands, they still kept coming towards us. They never really developed the fear of man, and hence we wiped them out in very short order. And we almost did that with the whales. Whales, likewise, are another creature that really likes to be around human beings. And so what happened during the whaling industry is that, you know, these ships would go out to hunt whales. The whales would come right towards the ships because they wanted contact with humans. We almost wiped them out, just like we did the passenger pigeons. So that's the context of what's going on in Genesis 9. God is saying, I'm giving you permission to hunt meat, but I'm going to put the fear of you upon all these animals so that you don't wipe them all out. Recognizing that since we're still sinners, we have the temptation saying, hey, this animal is easy to hunt. And I think that's also what happened to the mastodon. They were so easy to hunt and provided so much food with so little effort that we humans quickly wiped them out.
All kinds of people we've never heard of. This is so exciting. Look at this.
So, and then did you have a follow-up on that, Matt? I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, and let me add this. If you go to Genesis chapter 1, young earth creationists interpret verse 30 as a statement that all animals were vegetarian in the context of that passage. If you look at that passage, what God is saying to Adam and Eve, I'm giving you control over all life on planet Earth. You can rule over them, and you're to manage the planet's resources for your personal benefit and the benefit of all life. But take care of the green plants. The Hebrew word there basically refers to photosynthetic plants, photosynthetic vegetation. And basically what's happening in Genesis chapter 1, God is making the point that if you don't take care of the green vegetation, nobody gets to eat. All life fundamentally is dependent on photosynthetic life. And so that was the basis of that point there. It's not saying that there wasn't carnivorous activity at that time. And I love the fact that you cited the passages in Job about the horse, about how God designed the horse for battle. And also what you see in Job and in the Psalms is that God actually provides prey for the lion and for the raven as an expression of his love to those creatures. So here we see scripture actually endorsing carnivorous activity as an expression of God's love to those creatures. And, you know, this is not an issue centuries ago. What's happened in the 21st century, for the first time, the majority of human beings are living in large metropolitan cities. And so we don't have contact with the wild world, and therefore we don't realize how much herbivores benefit from the carnivores. If it wasn't for carnivorous activity, the death rate of the herbivores would skyrocket. Because what the carnivores do is they remove from the herbivore herds those creatures that are sick and in danger of infecting the other species. And also the carnivores make sure that the population level of the herbivores doesn't get so high that they wind up exhausting their entire food supply, and therefore you have a population collapse. What you notice about the non-human predators, is that they're designed by our Creator only to be able to kill the weak, the sick, the dying, and the wounded. And therefore, the healthy adult species are able to effectively escape predation. And there's this delicate balance between the capacity of the herbivores to escape predation and the ability of the predators to be able to get the food that they need. That delicate balance, I argue, is designed by the Creator to ensure the maximum health and population levels of the herbivores. Take away the predators, the herbivores are really in trouble. Incidentally, you can also extend that argument to parasites. Parasites likewise fulfill an important role in maintaining an optimal diversity and population levels of all life on planet Earth. Well, we got a bunch of hands up. I think, Ross, you've been waiting a long time, so I'll take your question next.
Okay, thanks. I want to expand on Doug's question. It's one thing to say that human beings as a species are responsible because of our behavior for a lot of the pain and suffering that exists in the world. But going back to his example of the one-year-old that dies, he had nothing to do with that. And what would we say to him if we could talk to him or to his parents about that argument? It wasn't his fault as an individual.
Very good question, Ross. And I would take that individual, I think it's Isaiah 58, the opening verses, verses 1 and 2, which basically addresses that question, how we have young people that have lived a virtuous life and they die and people wonder, you know, why did God take him at such a young age? But if you read the next verse, it basically says, only God knows the future of every one of us human beings. And in that future, if he sees significant suffering and the torment and distress, that he will take that person home early to avoid them. And I think an analogy I can give you is, I remember as an undergraduate student being in this lecture hall for a final physics exam, and the room was cold. I had gloves on trying to write this test. It was a 3-hour test. It was a very challenging test. And I knew ahead of time that none of us were going to be able to finish it. I was writing as fast as possible, trying to get through this test. And this professor kept walking up and down the aisles of all of us who were taking the test. And I was about an hour and 15 minutes into this 3-hour exam, and he snatched the test away from me. I said, "What are you doing?" And he says, "You can get out of here. I know you're going to get the top grade, so there's no point you spending another 2 hours of suffering through this. You can go." So I use that as an analogy. I mean, that professor kind of knew the state of the students in the class. Only God knows our future history. And in that future history, he sees distress and basically says of that young person, "Look, I already know the direction you're going. I know what's going to happen to you. And I know you have my heart. You have my redemption." And he says, "You know what? I'm going to bless you by taking you to a much better place, and so you don't have to go through all this pain and suffering." I often read that passage when I'm conducting a funeral where someone as young has died. And these days I consider anybody who dies before they reach the age of 60, they've died young. I mean, even 70. I mean, in fact, I remember one time I was speaking at this church and I realized everybody in this congregation is old. And then somebody reminded me that I was probably the oldest one in the room. So I still think of myself young, even though I'm in my 70s. But that's because God has blessed us with a capacity to live much longer than people lived in the past. But yeah, I mean, we all wonder when someone dies who's 40, and I think with this COVID-19, I've heard of people. In fact, I think of that doctor in China who was one of the first ones to discover this COVID-19. He was 34 years of age, saw what was going on, and said, "We got to do something about this." But he basically worked himself to death caring for all the patients and wound up dying of the virus. But you wonder, okay, maybe just God knew what he was in for because he was being silenced by the government. and just saw how virtuous an individual he was. His relationship with God was secure. It's like, hey, you don't have to finish this test. You can come home early. We just don't know. Okay, I'll take a question from, let's see, I think S-P-O-S-T-A, you are next.
Thanks. From the cosmic creation event until the creation of man, numerous billions of years transpired. Is there any biblical mention of whether the new creation has begun yet, or is that something that will only start way in the distant future sometime?
Well, it was Jesus who said in chapter 14 of John, I go away to prepare a place for you. I think he was referring to the new creation. And so he's there constructing it. It may be finished by now, but evidently there's no one there, at least no humans that are there, because we're told only after the great white throne judgment are human beings, redeemed human beings, going to be allowed to enter the new creation. So it may still be under construction. It may be finished, but we now know that it's vacant of humans until the great white throne judgment, as mentioned in the Revelation 20.
Thank you.
Okay, and Yevon, you've had your hand up.
I have a question on the book of Genesis.
Yes.
So, actually two questions. Did Neanderthals existed when Adam and Eve was created? And also the serpent mentioned in the book of Genesis, is it an actual serpent or is a serpentine creature?
Okay, good questions. Yes, there is evidence that Neanderthals were living at the same time as humans. The dates are not definitive. I mean, we know, for example, from carbon 14 dating that humans go back at least 40,000 years. And there's indirect dating methods that tell us that humans may go back 80,000 years. And then there's evidence that Neanderthals were around at least until about 50,000 years ago, but the error bar in that is significant. So yeah, the data does allow for some contact between Neanderthals and the humans. What we do know is that if that contact took place, it was short-lived, that Neanderthals quickly went extinct around 45,000 years ago. And a lot of people speculate that when they first came into contact with humans, humans so outcompeted them that they went extinct. I mean, I just made mention of the fact that they're designed for a cold climate, we're designed for a warm climate, but because we had clothing technology and the ability to control fire, we were able to take over all the territories that they were occupying and literally outcompete them. And so there's scientific papers saying that's why they went extinct. But to some degree, it's speculative. We just don't have really good evidence. So, and there's a genetic claim that humans and Neanderthals interbred, but it's not definitive. I mean, I do agree that there's scientific evidence for that event, but in no way is it compelling. So the jury is still out about whether or not that really happened. And the real big debate is over, okay, did Neanderthals and humans share common deleterious mutations, or are we really mistaken? I mean, for example, what we see is that you've got greater similarity between Neanderthal DNA and Northern European DNA, but they're dealing with the same climate conditions and the same environmental conditions. So it's quite possible that they were developing the skin color and the hair color as a way to be able to survive in a high latitude region there in Europe. So again, the jury's still out on that. Your question on Genesis again.
It was about the serpent. So is it an actual serpent or a serpentine-like creature?
Well, it's hard to tell because angels are endowed with a capability of taking on any physical form that they choose. So it could have been Satan taking over the body of some serpentine-like creature. or it could be he just appeared as a serpent. And a lot of people debated, is it a dragon-type creature? Is it a serpent-type? Is it a snake? I mean, the term serpent there in the Hebrew's got a fairly broad definition. So that those are the two scenarios. He could have taken over the control of a body of an animal, or he could have appeared like that animal. I mean, after all, angels can also appear as a flying saucer. They can appear as a leprechaun. So given that they got those kinds of powers, I think it's speculative exactly what was going on there. But he appeared in some noticeable physical form. Exactly how, we don't know.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay, who's next? And we got about 5 more minutes before we need to end. So if you got a question, now's the time.
Mark Durham here.
Mark, I see you. Go for it.
Question regarding the false prophet in Revelation 13 and 19.
Yes.
Also called the second beast from the land. Is the false prophet the false prophet of the harlot church or of the Antichrist or of both?
Well, if you read on in Revelation and chapter 20, it talks about how the Antichrist and the false prophet will be the first to be thrown into hell. So they're going to be the first inhabitants of hell. So that indicates that they're actual personal beings rather than symbols of some kind of system. But I'm showing you my bias. My interpretation of the book of Revelation is that we're to read it literally unless we see symbols that tell us where to take it symbolically. And I add to that, I only take it symbolically if the symbols are defined somewhere else in the Bible. Because what I notice is John, in writing the Revelation, frequently uses symbols, but these are all symbols that have been defined in books of the Old Testament. That's why when I taught a 7-year class in the book of Revelation, I told them, look, we're not going to just be studying Revelation. We're going to be also going through all the Old Testament books that John refers to through his symbolism. But often people are trying to interpret all of Revelation as symbolic and inventing symbols that are not used anywhere else in Scripture. My interpretive tool is I only take it symbolic if the symbol is defined somewhere else in the Bible. So I see it as an internally consistent book. But on that basis, I would conclude both the false prophet and the Antichrist are personal beings. Okay, we got time for one more question. Karina, I see you. I'm going to let you take the last question. Go for it.
Okay, thank you. No, just a quick question. How can you explain people living more than hundreds of years before, since modern medicines show us that people live longer now than before?
Okay, how is it, in other words, your question is, how is it that people in the days before the flood could live 800 or 900 years, and today we can only live a maximum of 120? Is that your question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I devote a chapter to that in my book, Navigating Genesis, and citing research by a Russian and a British astronomer who have been studying high energy, heavy nuclei cosmic rays. And over a 40-year period, they've been writing research papers basically documenting that over 95% of these heavy nuclei, fast-moving cosmic rays come from a single supernova event, where that event took place sometime during the last 100,000 years. And so this leaves open the possibility that people living before Noah were not exposed to those cosmic rays, and people living after Noah were. And those are the cosmic rays that do the greatest health damage. And so if those cosmic rays weren't a factor, that would leave open the possibility that humans actually could live longer than 120 years. That would also require that humans be vegetarian, because if you're eating meat, you're not going to make it 800 or 900 years. And also, you're going to need to avoid close contact with igneous rocks. Today, all of us are exposed to igneous rocks. I mean, concrete's everywhere. But in the days before the flood, where people were living locally, not globally, it would be possible if they were living in these sedimentary plains that they would have been protected from the uranium and thorium that is in these igneous rocks. That would be another reason why they could live longer. And finally, it would be important that their telomerase activity not be as aggressive as it is today. I mean, one reason we can't make it past 120 years is our chromosomes get shorter and shorter as we get older and older. And eventually they get so short that we can't live any longer. And that's actually a benefit because of the radiation environment in which we live. We are much more subject to cancer than people who weren't experiencing a high radiation environment. And to keep cancer in check, we have telomerase activity that basically prevents these cancers from multiplying out of control and all the population at early ages. But if radiation wasn't as extreme, cancer risk would be a lot lower and there wouldn't be a need to have our chromosomes being shortened as aggressively as they are. But this would indicate that God did something to the human genome at the time of the flood. So I'm arguing that there might have been some kind of supernatural intervention, exactly what we don't know. And there's other factors that impact lifespan as well. Those aren't the only ones, but I would argue those are probably the four most significant. Okay, with that, I'm going to close our time out for prayer. All of this will be up on the web, except the part on vitamin C. Again, my apologies for not hitting the record button. And right now, I'll stop the recording, and we'll close our time in prayer.